1987, Philadelphia. 1.7 million African Americans were unemployed. Youth ages 16 and 19, representing 7% of Philly's workforce, accounted for 20% of the unemployed population. Reaganomics left the urban underclass especially vulnerable. The last thing these communities could tolerate was a new drug, let alone one that offered a euphoric shot of pleasure to men and women who had been slowly beaten down by years of disappointment. One which could dissolve maternal instincts and societal pressures and stuff a few bills into the pockets of a generation of youth acutely aware of what felt like irreversible poverty. Although they were the last things African American communities needed, in the late 80s, a new high that promised a new lifestyle and a way to participate in the new economy swept through Philadelphia's streets. It was crack cocaine. Crack cocaine sold cheaper than rock cocaine, but was similarly addictive. Due to the advent of this new drug, crack houses began popping up on Philly blocks, distinguishable by the high volume of traffic well into the night, with both drug users and dealers walking in and out or pulling up in cars all night long. Our quiet block of Woodstock was no exception. An abandoned row home right across from our house quickly transformed into a crack house right before our eyes. Zombie-like drug addicts that we call fiends or base heads walked the night streets, causing the safety in the neighborhood to become questioned. To us, drugs represented dilapidation and fear, but on the other side of the game were luxury and opulence. Raymond, who ran the Woodstock crack house, was never spotted without the newest pair of Casale shades, furry Kangol hat, new Adidas sweatsuit. His haircut was crisp, his style immaculate, and Raymond looked like he belonged in an Eric B. and Rakim video. If he spotted us playing football on the block, he'd sometimes slide us kids $50, saying, "Get yourself something nice, and get your mom something too." When he wasn't leaned back inside of his pearl-white 87 BMW E28 M5, Raymond could be seen bopping down the street with a gigantic boombox, which probably took somewhere around 20D batteries to power. He'd play the same song every day, in or out of his car, almost like clockwork. "It Takes Two" by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. Raymond's songs out of that boombox are probably my earliest hip-hop memory. The beat was infectious. The use of the now famous "Yeah, Woo" break, a brilliant combination of Bobby Bird and James Brown sample, played throughout the song, anchored by a neck-snapping drum track that would make any listener do the wop. The lyrics, so boastful and proud, were sung with such a swagger that made anybody repeating these words feel like the man or the woman. "Cause I'm a winner, no, not a loser. To be an MC is what I choose. Ladies love me, girls adore me. I mean, even the ones that never saw me, like the way that I rhyme at a show. The reason why, man, I don't know. So let's go." So Raymond played this song over and over again and mouthed the words like he wrote them. The Woodstock Street crack house lasted till later in the year, when a police sting took the house down and made several arrests. The officers knocked the door down at 2 a.m. with a battering ram. While they were downstairs making arrests, Raymond somehow managed to jump from the second floor window, land on his back, and miraculously get up and sprint down the block, dropping money and crack vials as he ran. The stuff of legend. Never saw Raymond again after that morning. Witnesses saw this firsthand and would say that it was more effective as a deterrent than any scared straight program. Many experts blame the rise of hip-hop music alongside drug culture as the beginning of a dangerous type of hyper-masculinity in urban America. I wasn't a fighter, but I can't lie, a hard rap song can do wonders for the psyche of the mild-mannered listener. Don't believe me? Just throw on M.O.P.'s "Annie Up" in a crowded club and watch it go. Honestly, I attribute just as much of my reckless behavior to the impact of pro wrestling as to hip hop. And that's where we're going to begin. The WWF, World Wrestling Federation, programming dominated more of my Saturdays than cartoons. Although they started each broadcast with this huge, long, "Don't try this at home" speech that I can still recite verbatim to this day, after the broadcast, we'd all go outside and we start our own WWF, Woodstock Wrestling Federation. On the cold, hard concrete, we tried everything of what we saw at home. High-flying maneuvers, dramatic storylines, you name it. We even drew and cut out championship title belts using large refrigerator cardboard, previously used for our attempts at breakdancing, but that was over. I'd say that Macho Man Randy Savage flying off the top rope influenced me just as much as KRS-One holding a Mac-10 on the cover of Boogie Down Productions in 1988. Hopped up on hip-hop, I fought my best friend Patrick over a girl who I didn't even like. I stole from stores, friends. Riled up on pro wrestling, I got my front tooth knocked out when a kid who was much bigger than me dropped a huge Hulk Hogan leg drop on the back of my head while I lay on the concrete floor. I was even suspended once for trying to impress a girl by punching a brick wall, emulating Ronnie Hands of Stone Garvin. Karis once said, "'Cause where I'm at, if you're soft, you're lost," and we believed it. So before video games even, wrestling and hip-hop were the only two things that mattered to my young mind. Capping off the epic WrestleMania 4 main event, my guy, Macho Man Randy Savage, would beat Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase at the end of a grueling tournament. We couldn't get to Jersey to watch the landmark event, but the Philadelphia Spectrum opened its doors to broadcast the pay-per-view on closed-circuit TV. I wish they would still do that. My mom allowed my cousin Howie to take me. I bought a Macho Man foam finger, and I cheered Savage all the way to victory from my seat. I was responsible for that, because all I did was repeat his trademark, "Ooh, yeah," the entire show and the long subway ride back home from South Philly. 1988 also marked the release of the Nintendo Entertainment System's action set, which included a zapper-like gun and a dual game cartridge containing Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt. The system was originally released in 86, and it sold 7 million systems in 88 alone after a really strong debut. Howie had the NES since its release. He had a mother and a father who were separated, so he got two separate birthdays, two separate Christmases, and I loved it because he was always willing to share. But I wanted my own, so my mother brought me an action set after months of cajoling. I couldn't purchase any of the top titles as they all came with a $40 or $50 price tag. I've had a good month, meaning good grades, no trouble, all chores done, no back talk, then I could get a bargain bin game, which was usually $19.99. That price point meant a poorly built third-party game that had little fanfare. These games usually made good trade fodder, although no one really was allowed to make trades at that time. More on that later. One day, though, I picked up Mega Man 1. I was lucky enough to find it in the bargain bin at a local store named Clover, and my obsession with Mega Man would begin. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with a new story. Peace.